range of ages. A similar relationship between a lack of sleep and violence has been observed in adult prison populations. Places that, I should add, are woefully poor at enabling good sleep that could reduce aggression, violence, psychiatric disturbance, and suicide, which, beyond the humanitarian concern, increases costs to the taxpayer. Equally problematic issues arise from extreme swings in positive mood, though the consequences are different. Hypersensitivity to pleasurable experiences can lead to sensation-seeking, risk-taking, and addiction. Sleep disturbance is a recognized hallmark associated with addictive substance use. Insufficient sleep also determines relapse rates in numerous addiction disorders, associated with reward cravings that are unmetered, lacking control from the rational head office of the brain's prefrontal cortex. Relevant from a prevention standpoint, insufficient sleep during childhood significantly predicts early onset of drug and alcohol use in that same child during their later adolescent years, even when controlling for other high-risk traits, such as anxiety, attention deficits, and parental history of drug use. You can now appreciate why the bidirectional, pendulum-like emotional liability caused by sleep deprivation is so concerning, rather than counterbalancing. Our brain scanning experiments in healthy individuals offered reflections on the relationship between sleep and psychiatric illnesses. There is no major psychiatric condition in which sleep is normal. This is true of depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder, once known as manic depression. Psychiatry has long been aware of the coincidence between sleep disturbance and mental illness. However, a prevailing view in psychiatry has been that mental disorders cause sleep disruption, a one-way street of influence. Instead, we have demonstrated that otherwise healthy people can experience a neurological pattern of brain activity similar to that observed in many of these psychiatric conditions simply by having their sleep disrupted or blocked. Indeed, many of the brain regions commonly impacted by psychiatric mood disorders are the same regions that are involved in sleep regulation and impacted by sleep loss. Further, many of the genes that show abnormalities in psychiatric illnesses are the same genes that help control sleep and our circadian rhythms. Had psychiatry got the causal direction wrong, and it was sleep disruption instigating mental illness, not the other way around? No, I believe that it is equally inaccurate and reductionist to suggest. Instead, I firmly believe that sleep loss and mental illness is best described as a two-way street of interaction, with the flow of traffic being stronger in one direction or the other, depending on the disorder. I am not suggesting that all psychiatric conditions are caused by absent sleep. However, I am suggesting that sleep disruption remains a neglected factor, contributing to the instigation and/or maintenance of numerous psychiatric illnesses, and has powerful diagnostic and therapeutic potential that we are yet to fully understand or make use of. Preliminary, but compelling, evidence is beginning to support this claim. One example involves bipolar disorder, which most people will recognize by the former name of manic depression. Bipolar disorder should not be confused with major depression, in which individuals slide exclusively down into the negative end of the mood spectrum. Instead, patients with bipolar depression vacillate between both ends of the emotion spectrum, experiencing dangerous periods of mania, excessive, reward-driven emotional behavior, and also periods of deep depression, negative moods and emotions. These extremes are often separated by a time when the patients are in a stable emotional state, neither manic nor depressed. A research team in Italy examined bipolar patients during the time when they were in this stable, inter-episode phase. Next, under careful clinical supervision, they sleep-deprived these individuals for one night. Almost immediately, a large proportion of the individuals either spiraled into a manic episode or became seriously depressed. I find it to be an ethically difficult experiment to appreciate, But the scientists had importantly demonstrated that a lack of sleep is a causal trigger of a psychiatric episode of mania or depression. The result supports a mechanism in which the sleep disruption, which almost always precedes the shift from a stable to an unstable manic or depressive state in bipolar patients, may well be a, the trigger in the disorder, and not simply epiphenomenal. Thankfully, the opposite is also true. Should you improve sleep quality in patients suffering from several psychiatric conditions using a technique we will discuss later, called Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia, CBTI, you can improve symptom severity and remission rates. My colleague at the University of California, Berkeley, Dr. Allison Harvey, has been a pioneer in this regard. By improving sleep quantity, quality, and regularity, Harvey and her team have systematically demonstrated the healing abilities of sleep for the minds of numerous psychiatric populations. She has intervened with the therapeutic tool of sleep in conditions as diverse as depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety, and suicide, all to great effect. By regularizing and enhancing sleep, Harvey has stepped these patients back from the edge of crippling mental illness. That, in my opinion, is a truly remarkable service to humanity. The swings in emotional brain activity that we observed in healthy individuals who were sleep-deprived may also explain a finding that has perplexed psychiatry for decades. Patients suffering from major depression, in which they become exclusively locked into the negative end of the mood spectrum, show what at first appears to be a counterintuitive response to one night of sleep deprivation. Approximately 30-40% of these patients will feel better after a night without sleep. Their lack of slumber appears to be an antidepressant. The reason sleep deprivation is not a commonly used treatment, however, is twofold. First, as soon as these individuals do sleep, the antidepressant benefit goes away. Second, the 60-70% of patients who do not respond to the sleep deprivation will actually feel worse, deepening their depression. As a result, sleep deprivation is not a realistic or comprehensive therapy option. Still, it has posed an interesting question. How could sleep deprivation prove helpful for some of these individuals, yet detrimental to others? I believe that the explanation resides in the bidirectional changes in emotional brain activity that we observed. Depression is not, as you may think, just about the excess presence of negative feelings. Major depression has as much to do with absence of positive emotions, a feature described as anhedonia, the inability to gain pleasure from normally pleasurable experiences, such as food, socializing, or sex. The one-third of depressed individuals who respond to sleep deprivation may therefore be those who experience the greater amplification within reward circuits of the brain that I described earlier, resulting in far stronger sensitivity to, and experiencing of, positive rewarding triggers following sleep deprivation. The anhedonia is therefore lessened, and now they can begin to experience a greater degree of pleasure from pleasurable life experiences. In contrast, the other two-thirds of depressed patients may suffer the opposite negative emotional consequences of sleep deprivation more dominantly, a worsening rather than alleviation of their depression. If we can identify what determines those who will be responders and those who will not, my hope is that we can create better, more tailored sleep intervention methods for combating depression. We will revisit the effects of sleep loss on emotional stability and other brain functions in later chapters, when we discuss the real-life consequences of sleep loss in society, education, and the workplace. The findings justify our questioning of whether or not sleep-deprived doctors can make emotionally rational decisions and judgments. Underslept military personnel should have their fingers on the triggers of weaponry. Overworked bankers and stock traders can make rational, non-risky financial decisions when investing the public's hard-earned retirement funds. And if teenagers should be battling against impossibly early start times during a developmental phase of life, when they are most vulnerable to developing psychiatric disorders. For now, however, I will summarize this section by offering a discerning quote on the topic of sleep and emotion by the American entrepreneur E. Joseph Kosman. The best bridge between despair and hope is a good night's sleep. Tired and forgetful? Have you ever pulled an all-nighter, deliberately staying awake all night? One of my true loves is teaching a large undergraduate class on the science of sleep at the University of California, Berkeley. I taught a similar sleep course while I was at Harvard University. At the start of the course, I conduct a sleep survey, inquiring about my students' sleep habits, such as the times they go to bed and wake up during the week and weekend, how much sleep they get, if they think their academic performance is related to their sleep. Inasmuch as they are telling me the truth, they fill the survey out anonymously online, not in class. The answer I routinely get is saddening. More than 85% of them pull all-nighters. Especially concerning is the fact that of those who said yes to pulling all-nighters, almost a third will do so monthly, weekly, or even several times a week. As the course continues throughout the semester, I return to the results of their sleep survey and link their own sleep habits with the science we are learning about. In this way, I try to point out the very personal dangers they face to their psychological and physical health due to their insufficient sleep, and the danger they themselves pose to society as a consequence. The most common reason my students give for pulling all-nighters is to cram for an exam. In 2006, I decided to conduct an MRI study to investigate whether they were right or wrong to do so. Was pulling an all-nighter a wise idea for learning? We took a large group of individuals and assigned them to either a sleep group or a sleep deprivation group. Both groups remained awake normally across the first day. Across the following night, those in the sleep group obtained a full night of shut-eye, while those in the sleep deprivation group were kept awake all night under the watchful eye of trained staff in my lab. Both groups were then awake across the following morning. Around midday, we placed participants inside an MRI scanner and had them try to learn a list of facts, one at a time, as we took snapshots of their brain activity. Then we tested them to see how effective that learning had been. However, instead of testing them immediately after learning, we waited until they had had 2 nights of recovery sleep. We did this to make sure that any impairments we observed in the sleep-deprived group were not confounded by them being too sleepy or inattentive to recollect what they may very well have learned. Therefore, the sleep deprivation manipulation was only in effect during the act of learning and not during the latter act of recall. When we compared the effectiveness of learning between the two groups, the result was clear. There was a 40% deficit in the ability of the sleep-deprived group to cram new facts into the brain, that is to say, make new memories, relative to the group that obtained a full night of sleep. To put that in context, it would be the difference between acing an exam and failing it miserably. What was going wrong within the brain to produce these deficits? We compared the patterns of brain activity during attempted learning between the two groups and focused our analysis on the brain region that we spoke about in Chapter 6, the hippocampus, the information inbox of the brain that acquires new facts. There was lots of healthy, learning-related activity in the hippocampus in the participants who had slept the night before. However, when we looked at this same brain structure in the sleep-deprived participants, we could not find any significant learning activity whatsoever. It was as though sleep deprivation had shut down their memory inbox, and any new incoming information was simply being bounced. You don't even need the blunt force of a whole night of sleep deprivation. Simply disrupting the depth of an individual's NREM sleep with infrequent sounds, preventing deep sleep and keeping the brain in shallow sleep without waking the individual up, will produce similar brain deficits and learning impairments. You may have seen a movie called Memento, in which the lead character suffers brain damage and, from that point forward, can no longer make any new memories. In neurology, he is what we call densely amnesic. The part of his brain that was damaged was the hippocampus. It is the very same structure that sleep deprivation will attack, blocking your brain's capacity for new learning. I cannot tell you how many of my students have come up to me at the end of the lecture in which I described these studies and said, "I know that exact feeling. It seems as though I'm staring at the page of the textbook, but nothing is going in. I may be able to hold on to some facts the following day for the exam, but if you were to ask me to take that same test a month later, I think I'd hardly remember a thing." The latter description has scientific backing. Those few memories you are able to learn while sleep-deprived are forgotten far more quickly in the hours and days thereafter. Memories formed without sleep are weaker memories, evaporating rapidly. Studies in rats have found that it is almost impossible to strengthen the synaptic connections between individual neurons that normally forge a new memory circuit in the animals that have been sleep-deprived. Imprinting lasting memories into the architecture of the brain becomes nearly impossible. This is true whether the researchers sleep-deprived the rats for a full 24 hours, or just a little, for 2 or 3 hours. Even the most elemental units of the learning process, the production of proteins that form the building blocks of memories within these synapses, are stunted by the state of sleep loss. The very latest work in this area has revealed that sleep deprivation even impacts the DNA and the learning-related genes in the brain cells of the hippocampus itself. A lack of sleep, therefore, is a deeply penetrating and corrosive force that enfeebles the memory-making apparatus within your brain, preventing you from constructing lasting memory traces. It is rather like building a sandcastle too close to the tide line. The consequences are inevitable. While at Harvard University, I was invited to write my first op-ed piece for their newspaper, The Crimson. The topic was sleep loss, learning, and memory. It was also the last piece I was invited to write. In the article, I described the above studies and their relevance, returning time and again to the pandemic of sleep deprivation that was sweeping through the student body. However, rather than lambaste the students for these practices, I pointed a scolding finger directly at the faculty, myself included. I suggested that if we, as teachers, strive to accomplish just that purpose, to teach, then end-loading exams in the final days of the semester was an asinine decision. It forced a behavior in our students, that of short sleeping or pulling all-nighters leading up to the exam, that was in direct opposition to the goals of nurturing young scholarly minds. I argued that logic, backed by scientific fact, must prevail, and that it was long past the time for us to rethink our evaluation methods, their contra-educational impact, and the unhealthy behavior it coerced from our students. To suggest that the reaction from the faculty was icy would be a thermal compliment. It was the student's choice, I was told in adamant response emails. A lack of planned study by irresponsible undergraduates was another common rebuttal from faculty and administrators attempting to sidestep responsibility. In truth, I never believed that one op-ed column would trigger a U-turn in poor educational examination methods at that or any other higher institute of learning. As many have said about such stoic institutions, theories, beliefs, and practices die one generation at a time. But the conversation and battle must start somewhere. You may ask whether I have changed my own educational practice and assessment. I have. There are no final exams at the end of the semester in my classes. Instead, I split my courses up into thirds so that students only have to study a handful of lectures at a time. Furthermore, none of the exams are cumulative. It's a tried and true effect in the psychology of memory, described as mass versus spaced learning. As with a fine dining experience, it is far more preferable to separate the educational meal into smaller courses, with breaks in between to allow for digestion, rather than attempt to cram all of those informational calories down in one go. In Chapter 6, I describe the crucial role for sleep after learning in the offline cementing or consolidating of recently learned memories. My friend and longtime collaborator at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Robert Stickgold, conducted a clever study with wide-reaching implications. He had a total of 133 undergraduates learn a visual memory task through repetition. Participants then returned to his laboratory and were tested to see how much they had retained. Some subjects returned the next day after a full night of sleep. Others returned 2 days later after 2 nights of sleep, and still others after 3 days with 3 nights of sleep in between. As you would predict by now, a night of sleep strengthened the newly learned memories, boosting their retention. Additionally, the more nights of sleep participants had before they were tested, the better their memory was. All except another subgroup of participants. Like the subjects in the third group, these participants learned the task on the first day and learned it just as well. They were then tested 3 nights later, just like the third group before. The difference was that they were deprived of sleep the first night after learning and were not tested the following day. Instead, Stickgold gave them 2 full recovery nights of sleep before testing them. They showed absolutely no evidence of a memory consolidation improvement. In other words, if you don't sleep the very first night after learning, you lose the chance to consolidate those memories, even if you get lots of catch-up sleep thereafter. In terms of memory, then, sleep is not like the bank. You cannot accumulate a debt and hope to pay it off at a later point in time. Sleep for memory consolidation is an all-or-nothing event. It is a concerning result in our 24/7, hurry-up, don't-wait society. I feel another op-ed coming on. Sleep and Alzheimer's disease. The 2 most feared diseases throughout developed nations are dementia and cancer. Both are related to inadequate sleep. We will address the latter in the next chapter regarding sleep deprivation and the body. Regarding the former, which centers on the brain, a lack of sleep is fast becoming recognized as a key lifestyle factor determining whether or not you will develop Alzheimer's disease. The condition, originally identified in 1901 by German physician Dr. Aloysius Alzheimer, has become one of the largest public health and economic challenges of the 21st century. More than 40 million people suffer from the debilitating disease. That number has accelerated as the human lifespan has stretched, but also, importantly, as total sleep time has decreased. 1 in 10 adults over the age of 65 now suffers from Alzheimer's disease. Without advances in diagnosis, prevention, and therapeutics, the escalation will continue. Sleep represents a new candidate for hope on all 3 of these fronts: diagnosis, prevention, and therapeutics. Before discussing why, let me first describe how sleep disruption and Alzheimer's disease are causally linked. As we learned in Chapter 5, sleep quality, especially that of deep NREM sleep, deteriorates as we age. This is linked to a decline in memory. However, if you assess a patient with Alzheimer's disease, the disruption of deep sleep is far more exaggerated. More telling, perhaps, is the fact that sleep disturbance precedes the onset of Alzheimer's disease by several years, suggesting that it may be an early warning sign of the condition, or even a contributor to it. Following diagnosis, the magnitude of sleep disruption will then progress in unison with the symptom severity of the Alzheimer's patient, further suggesting a link between the two. Making matters worse, over 60% of patients with Alzheimer's disease have at least 1 clinical sleep disorder. Insomnia is especially common, as caregivers of a loved one with Alzheimer's disease will know all too well. It was not until relatively recently, however, that the association between disturbed sleep and Alzheimer's disease was realized to be more than just an association. While much remains to be understood, we now recognize that sleep disruption and Alzheimer's disease interact in a self-fulfilling, negative spiral that can initiate and/or accelerate the condition. Alzheimer's disease is associated with the buildup of a toxic form of protein called beta-amyloid, which aggregates in sticky clumps or plaques within the brain. Amyloid plaques are poisonous to neurons, killing the surrounding brain cells. What is strange, however, is that amyloid plaques only affect some parts of the brain and not others, the reasons for which remain unclear. What struck me about this unexplained pattern was the location in the brain where amyloid accumulates early in the course of Alzheimer's disease and most severely in the late stages of the condition. That area is the middle part of the frontal lobe, which, as you will remember, is the same brain region essential for the electrical generation of deep NREM sleep in healthy young individuals. At the time, we did not understand if or why Alzheimer's disease caused sleep disruption, but simply knew that they always co-occurred. I wondered whether the reason patients with Alzheimer's disease have such impaired deep NREM sleep was, in part, because the disease erodes the very region of the brain that normally generates this key stage of slumber. I joined forces with Dr. William Jagast, a leading authority on Alzheimer's disease, at the University of California, Berkeley. Together, our research team set about testing this hypothesis. Several years later, having assessed the sleep of many older adults with varying degrees of amyloid buildup in the brain that we quantified with a special type of PET scan, we arrived at the answer. The more amyloid deposits there were in the middle regions of the frontal lobe, the more impaired the deep sleep quality was in that older individual. And it was not just a general loss of deep sleep, which is common as we get older, but the very deepest of the powerful slow brainwaves of NREM sleep that the disease was ruthlessly eroding. This distinction was important, since it meant that the sleep impairment caused by amyloid buildup in the brain was more than just normal aging. It was unique, a departure from what is otherwise the signature of sleep decline as we get older. We are now examining whether this very particular dent in sleeping brainwave activity represents an early identifier of those who are at greatest risk from developing Alzheimer's disease years in advance. If sleep does prove to be an early diagnostic measure, especially one that is relatively cheap, non-invasive, and can be easily obtained in a large number of individuals, unlike costly MRI or PET scans, then early intervention becomes possible. Building on these findings, our recent work has added a key piece in the jigsaw puzzle of Alzheimer's disease. We have discovered a new pathway through which amyloid plaques may contribute to memory decline later in life, something that has been largely missing in our understanding of how Alzheimer's disease works. I mentioned that the toxic amyloid deposits only accumulate in some parts of the brain and not others. Despite Alzheimer's disease being typified by memory loss, the hippocampus, that key memory reservoir in the brain, is mysteriously unaffected by amyloid protein. This question has so far baffled scientists. How does amyloid cause memory loss in Alzheimer's disease patients when amyloid itself does not affect memory areas of the brain? While other aspects of the disease may be at play, it seemed plausible to me that there was a missing intermediary factor. One that was transacting the influence of amyloid in one part of the brain on memory, which depended on a different region of the brain. Was sleep disruption the missing factor? To test this theory, we had elderly patients with varying levels of amyloid, low to high, in their brains, learn a list of new facts in the evening. The next morning, after recording their sleep in the laboratory that night, we tested them to see how effective their sleep had been at cementing and thus holding on to those new memories. We discovered a chain reaction effect. Those individuals with the highest levels of amyloid deposits in the frontal regions of the brain had the most severe loss of deep sleep and, as a knock-on consequence, failed to successfully consolidate those new memories. Overnight, forgetting, rather than remembering, had taken place. The disruption of deep NREM sleep was therefore a hidden middleman, brokering the bad deal between amyloid and memory impairment in Alzheimer's disease, a missing link. These findings, however, were only half of the story, and admittedly the less important half. Our work had shown that the amyloid plaques of Alzheimer's disease may be associated with the loss of deep sleep, but does it work both ways? Can a lack of sleep actually cause amyloid to build up in your brain to begin with? If so, insufficient sleep across an individual's life would significantly raise their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Around the same time that we were conducting our studies, Dr. Makin Nedegaard at the University of Rochester made one of the most spectacular discoveries in the field of sleep research in recent decades. Working with mice, Nedegaard found that a kind of sewage network called the glymphatic system exists within the brain. Its name is derived from the body's equivalent lymphatic system, but it's composed of cells called glia, from the Greek root word for glue. Glial cells are distributed throughout your entire brain, situated side by side with the neurons that generate the electrical impulses of your brain. Just as the lymphatic system drains contaminants from your body, the glymphatic system collects and removes dangerous metabolic contaminants generated by the hard work performed by neurons in your brain, rather like a support team surrounding an elite athlete. Although the glymphatic system, the support team, is somewhat active during the day, Nedegaard and her team discovered that it is during sleep that this neural sanitization work kicks into high gear. Associated with the pulsing rhythm of deep NREM sleep comes a 10 to 20-fold increase in effluent expulsion from the brain. In what can be described as a nighttime power cleanse, the purifying work of the glymphatic system is accomplished by cerebrospinal fluid that bathes the brain. Nedegaard made a second astonishing discovery, which explained why the cerebrospinal fluid is so effective in flushing out metabolic debris at night. The glial cells of the brain were shrinking in size by up to 60% during NREM sleep, enlarging the space around the neurons and allowing the cerebrospinal fluid to proficiently clean out the metabolic refuse left by the day's neural activity. Think of the buildings of a large metropolitan city physically shrinking at night, allowing municipal cleaning crews easy access to pick up garbage strewn in the streets, followed by a good pressure jet treatment of every nook and cranny. When we wake each morning, our brains can once again function efficiently thanks to this deep cleansing. So what does this have to do with Alzheimer's disease? One piece of toxic debris evacuated by the glymphatic system during sleep is amyloid protein, the poisonous element associated with Alzheimer's disease. Other dangerous metabolic waste elements that have links to Alzheimer's disease are also removed by the cleaning process during sleep, including a protein called tau, as well as stress molecules produced by neurons when they combust energy and oxygen during the day. Should you experimentally prevent a mouse from getting NREM sleep, keeping it awake instead, there is an immediate increase in amyloid deposits within the brain. Without sleep, an escalation of poisonous Alzheimer's-related protein accumulated in the brains of the mice, together with several other toxic metabolites. Phrased differently, and perhaps more simply, wakefulness is low-level brain damage, while sleep is neurological sanitation. Nedegaard's findings completed the circle of knowledge that our findings had left unanswered. Inadequate sleep and the pathology of Alzheimer's disease interact in a vicious cycle. Without sufficient sleep, amyloid plaques build up in the brain, especially in deep sleep-generating regions, attacking and degrading them. The loss of deep NREM sleep caused by this assault therefore lessens the ability to remove amyloid from the brain at night, resulting in greater amyloid deposition. More amyloid, less deep sleep, more amyloid, and so on and so forth. From this cascade comes a prediction. Getting too little sleep across the adult lifespan will significantly raise your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Precisely this relationship has now been reported in numerous epidemiological studies, including those individuals suffering from sleep disorders, such as insomnia and sleep apnea. Parenthetically and unscientifically, I have always found it curious that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, two heads of state that were very vocal, if not proud, about sleeping only 4 to 5 hours a night, both went on to develop the ruthless disease. The current US president, Donald Trump, also a vociferous proclaimer of sleeping just a few hours each night, may want to take note. A more radical and converse prediction that emerges from these findings is that, by improving someone's sleep, we should be able to reduce their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, or at least delay its onset. Tentative support has emerged from clinical studies in which middle and older age adults have had their sleep disorders successfully treated. As a consequence, their rate of cognitive decline slowed significantly and further delayed the onset of Alzheimer's disease by 5 to 10 years. My own research group is now trying to develop a number of viable methods for artificially increasing deep NREM sleep that could restore some degree of the memory consolidation function that is absent in older individuals with high amounts of amyloid in the brain. If we can find a method that is cost-effective and can be scaled up to the population level for repeat use, my goal is prevention. Can we begin supplementing the declining deep sleep of vulnerable members of society during midlife, many decades before the tipping point of Alzheimer's disease is reached, aiming to avert dementia risk later in life? It is an admittedly lofty ambition, and some would argue a moonshot research goal. But it is worth recalling that we already use this conceptual approach in medicine, in the form of prescribing statins to higher-risk individuals in their 40s and 50s to help prevent cardiovascular disease, rather than having to treat it decades later. Insufficient sleep is only one among several risk factors associated with Alzheimer's disease. Sleep alone will not be the magic bullet that eradicates dementia. Nevertheless, prioritizing sleep across the lifespan is clearly becoming a significant factor for lowering Alzheimer's disease risk. Chapter 8. Cancer, heart attacks, and a shorter life. Sleep deprivation and the body. I was once fond of saying, sleep is the third pillar of good health, alongside diet and exercise. I have changed my tune. Sleep is more than a pillar. It is the foundation on which the other two health bastions sit. Take away the bedrock of sleep, or weaken it just a little, and careful eating or physical exercise become less than effective, as we shall see. Yet the insidious impact of sleep loss on health runs much deeper. Every major system, tissue and organ of your body, suffers when sleep becomes short. No aspect of your health can retreat at the sign of sleep loss and escape unharmed. Like water from a burst pipe in your home, the effects of sleep deprivation will seep into every nook and cranny of biology, down into your cells, even altering your most fundamental self, your DNA. Widening the lens of focus, there are more than 20 large-scale epidemiological studies that have tracked millions of people over many decades, all of which report the same clear relationship. The shorter your sleep, the shorter your life. The leading causes of disease and death in developed nations, diseases that are crippling healthcare systems, such as heart disease, obesity, dementia, diabetes, and cancer, all have recognized causal links to a lack of sleep. This chapter describes, uncomfortably, the many and varied ways in which insufficient sleep proves ruinous to all the major physiological systems of the human body: cardiovascular, metabolic, immune, reproductive. Sleep loss and the cardiovascular system. Unhealthy sleep, unhealthy heart. Simple and true. Take the results of a 2011 study that tracked more than 500,000 men and women of varied ages, races, and ethnicities across 8 different countries. Progressively shorter sleep was associated with a 45% increased risk of developing and or dying from coronary heart disease within 7 to 25 years from the start of the study. A similar relationship was observed in a Japanese study of over 4,000 male workers. Over a 14-year period, those sleeping 6 hours or less were 400 to 500% more likely to suffer one or more cardiac arrests than those sleeping more than 6 hours. I should note that in many of these studies, The relationship between short sleep and heart failure remained strong, even after controlling for other known cardiac risk factors, such as smoking, physical activity, and body mass. A lack of sleep more than accomplishes its own, independent attack on the heart. As we approach midlife, and our body begins to deteriorate and health resilience starts its decline, the impact of insufficient sleep on the cardiovascular system escalates. Adults 45 years or older, who sleep fewer than 6 hours a night, are 200% more likely to have a heart attack or stroke during their lifetime, as compared with those sleeping 7 to 8 hours a night. This finding impresses how important it is to prioritize sleep in midlife, which is unfortunately the time when family and professional circumstances encourage us to do the exact opposite. Part of the reason the heart suffers so dramatically under the weight of sleep deprivation concerns blood pressure. Have a quick look at your right forearm and pick out some veins. If you wrap your left hand around that forearm, just below the elbow, and grip it, like a tourniquet, you will see those vessels start to balloon. A little alarming, isn't it? The ease with which just a little sleep loss can pump up pressure in the veins of your entire body, stretching and distressing the vessel walls, is equally alarming. High blood pressure is so common nowadays that we forget the deathly toll it inflicts. This year alone, hypertension will steal more than 7 million people's lives by way of cardiac failure, ischemic heart disease, stroke, or kidney failure. Deficient sleep is responsible for many of these lost fathers, mothers, grandparents, and beloved friends. As with other consequences of sleep loss we've encountered, you don't need a full night of total sleep deprivation to inflict a measurable impact on your cardiovascular system. One night of modest sleep reduction, even just 1 or 2 hours, will promptly speed the contracting rate of a person's heart, hour upon hour, and significantly increase the systolic blood pressure within their vasculature. You will find no solace in the fact that these experiments were conducted in young, fit individuals, all of whom started out with an otherwise healthy cardiovascular system just hours before. Such physical fitness proves no match for a short night of sleep. It affords no resistance. Beyond accelerating your heart rate and increasing your blood pressure, a lack of sleep further erodes the fabric of those strained blood vessels, especially those that feed the heart itself, called the coronary arteries. These corridors of life need to be clean and open wide to supply your heart with blood at all times. Narrow or block those passageways, and your heart can suffer a comprehensive and often fatal attack caused by blood oxygen starvation, colloquially known as a massive coronary. One cause of a coronary artery blockage is atherosclerosis, or the furring up of those heart corridors with hardened plaques that contain calcium deposits. Researchers at the University of Chicago studied almost 500 healthy midlife adults, none of whom had any existing heart disease or signs of atherosclerosis. They tracked the health of the coronary arteries of these participants for a number of years, all the while assessing their sleep. If you were one of the individuals who were obtaining just 5 to 6 hours each night or less, you were 200 to 300% more likely to suffer calcification of your coronary arteries over the next 5 years, relative to those individuals sleeping 7 to 8 hours. The deficient sleep of those individuals was associated with a closing off of the critical passageways that should otherwise be wide open and feeding the heart with blood, starving it and significantly increasing the risk of a coronary heart attack. Although the mechanisms by which sleep deprivation degrades cardiovascular health are numerous, they all appear to cluster around a common culprit, called the sympathetic nervous system. Abandon any thoughts of love or serene compassion based on the misguiding name. The sympathetic nervous system is resolutely activating, inciting, even agitating. If needed, it will mobilize the evolutionarily ancient fight-or-flight stress response within the body, comprehensively and in a matter of seconds. Like an accomplished general in command of a vast military, the sympathetic nervous system can muster activity in a vast assortment of the body's physiological divisions, from respiration, immune function, and stress chemicals to blood pressure and heart rate. An acute stress response from the sympathetic nervous system, which is normally only deployed for short periods of time, lasting minutes to hours, can be highly adaptive under conditions of credible threat, such as the potential of real physical attack. Survival is the goal, and these responses promote immediate action to accomplish just that. But leave that system stuck in the on position for long durations of time, and sympathetic activation becomes deeply maladaptive. In fact, it is a killer. With few exceptions over the past half century, every experiment that has investigated the impact of deficient sleep on the human body has observed an overactive sympathetic nervous system. For as long as the state of insufficient sleep lasts, and for some time thereafter, the body remains stuck in some degree of a fight-or-flight state. It can last for years in those with an untreated sleep disorder, excessive work hours that limit sleep or its quality, or the simple neglect of sleep by an individual. Like a car engine that is revved to a shrieking extreme for sustained periods of time, your sympathetic nervous system is flawed into perpetual overdrive by a lack of sleep. The consequential strain that is placed on your body by the persistent force of sympathetic activation will leak out in all manner of health issues, just like the failed pistons, gaskets, seals, and gnashing gears of an abused car engine. Through this central pathway of an overactive sympathetic nervous system, sleep deprivation triggers a domino effect that will spread like a wave of health damage throughout your body. It starts with removing a default resting brake that normally prevents your heart from accelerating in its rate of contraction. Once this brake is released, you will experience sustained speeds of cardiac beating. As your sleep-deprived heart beats faster, the volumetric rate of blood pumped through your vasculature increases, and with that comes the hypertensive state of your blood pressure. Occurring at the same time is a chronic increase in a stress hormone called cortisol, which is triggered by the overactive sympathetic nervous system. One undesirable consequence of the sustained deluge of cortisol is the constriction of those blood vessels, triggering an even greater increase in blood pressure. Making matters worse, growth hormone, a great healer of the body, which normally surges at night, is shut off by the state of sleep deprivation. Without growth hormone to replenish the lining of your blood vessels, called the endothelium, they will be slowly shorn and stripped of their integrity. Adding insult to real injury, the hypertensive strain that sleep deprivation places on your vasculature means that you can no longer repair those fracturing vessels effectively. The damaged and weakened state of vascular plumbing throughout your body now becomes systematically more prone to atherosclerosis, arteries furring up. Vessels will rupture. It is a powder keg of factors, with heart attack and stroke being the most common casualties in the explosive aftermath. Compare this cascade of harm to the healing benefits that a full night of sleep normally lavishes on the cardiovascular system. During deep NREM sleep specifically, the brain communicates a calming signal to the fight-or-flight sympathetic branch of the body's nervous system, and does so for long durations of the night. As a result, deep sleep prevents an escalation of this physiological stress that is synonymous with increased blood pressure, heart attack, heart failure, and stroke. This includes a calming effect on the contracting speed of your heart. Think of your deep NREM sleep as a natural form of nighttime blood pressure management, one that averts hypertension and stroke. When communicating science to the general public in lectures or writing, I'm always wary of bombarding an audience with never-ending mortality and morbidity statistics, lest they themselves lose the will to live in front of me. It is hard not to do so with such compelling masses of studies in the field of sleep deprivation. Often, however, a single astonishing result is all that people need to apprehend the point. For cardiovascular health, I believe that finding comes from a global experiment in which 1.5 billion people are forced to reduce their sleep by 1 hour or less for a single night each year. It is very likely that you have been part of this experiment, otherwise known as daylight savings time. In the Northern Hemisphere, the switch to daylight savings time in March results in most people losing an hour of sleep opportunity. Should you tabulate millions of daily hospital records, as researchers have done, you discover that this seemingly trivial sleep reduction comes with a frightening spike in heart attacks the following day. Impressively, it works both ways. In the autumn within the Northern Hemisphere, when the clocks move forward and we gain an hour of sleep opportunity time, rates of heart attacks plummet the day after. A similar rise and fall relationship can be seen with the number of traffic accidents, proving that the brain, by way of attention lapses and microsleeps, is just as sensitive as the heart to very small perturbations of sleep. Most people think nothing of losing an hour of sleep for a single night, believing it to be trivial and inconsequential. It is anything but. Sleep loss and metabolism, diabetes and weight gain. The less you sleep, the more you are likely to eat. In addition, your body becomes unable to manage those calories effectively, especially the concentrations of sugar in your blood. In these two ways, sleeping less than 7 or 8 hours a night will increase your probability of gaining weight, being overweight, or being obese, and significantly increases your likelihood of developing type 2 diabetes. The global health cost of diabetes is $375 billion a year. That of obesity is more than $2 trillion. Yet for the underslept individual, the cost to health, quality of life, and a hastened arrival of death are more meaningful. Precisely how a lack of sleep sets you on a path toward diabetes and leads to obesity is now well understood and incontrovertible. Diabetes. Sugar is a dangerous thing. In your diet, yes. But here I'm referring to that which is currently circulating in your bloodstream. Excessively high levels of blood sugar, or glucose, over weeks or years, inflicts a surprising harm to the tissues and organs of your body, worsens your health, and shortens your lifespan. Eye disease that can end in blindness, nerve disease that commonly results in amputations, and kidney failure necessitating dialysis or transplant are all consequences of prolonged high blood sugar, as are hypertension and heart disease. But it is the condition of type 2 diabetes that is most commonly and immediately related to unregulated blood sugar. In a healthy individual, the hormone insulin will trigger the cells of your body to swiftly absorb glucose from the bloodstream, should it increase, as happens after eating a meal. Instructed by insulin, the cells of your body will open special channels on their surface that operate like wonderfully efficient roadside drains at the height of a downpour. They have no problem dealing with the deluge of glucose coursing down the transit arteries, averting what could otherwise be a dangerous flood of sugar in the bloodstream. If the cells of your body stop responding to insulin, however, they cannot efficiently absorb glucose from the blood. Similar to roadside drains that become blocked or erroneously closed shut, the rising swell of blood sugar cannot be brought back down to safe levels. At this point, the body has transitioned into a hyperglycemic state. Should this condition persist, and the cells of your body remain intolerant to dealing with the high levels of glucose, you will transition into a pre-diabetic state and, ultimately, develop full-blown type 2 diabetes. Early warning signs of a link between sleep loss and abnormal blood sugar emerged in a series of large epidemiological studies spanning several continents. Independent of one another, the research groups found far higher rates of type 2 diabetes among individuals that reported sleeping less than 6 hours a night routinely. The association remained significant even when adjusting for other contributing factors, such as body weight, alcohol, smoking, age, gender, race, and caffeine use. Powerful as these studies are, though, they do not inform the direction of causality. Does the state of diabetes impair your sleep, or does short sleep impair your body's ability to regulate blood sugar, thereby causing diabetes? To answer this question, Scientists had to conduct carefully controlled experiments with healthy adults who had no existing signs of diabetes or issues with blood sugar. In the first of these studies, participants were limited to sleeping 4 hours a night for just 6 nights. By the end of that week, these formerly healthy participants were 40% less effective at absorbing a standard dose of glucose compared to when they were fully rested. To give you a sense of what that means, if the researchers showed those blood sugar readings to an unwitting family doctor, the GP would immediately classify that individual as being pre-diabetic. They would start a rapid intervention program to prevent the development of irreversible type 2 diabetes. Numerous scientific laboratories around the world have replicated this alarming effect of short sleep, some with even less aggressive reductions in sleep amount. How does a lack of sleep hijack the body's effective control of blood sugar? Was it a blockade of insulin release, removing the essential instruction for cells to absorb glucose? Or had the cells themselves become unresponsive to an otherwise normal and present message of insulin? As we have discovered, both are true, though the most compelling evidence indicates the latter. By taking small tissue samples, or biopsies, from participants at the end of the above experiments, we can examine how the cells of the body are operating. After participants had been restricted to 4 to 5 hours of sleep for a week, the cells of these tired individuals had become far less receptive to insulin. In this sleep-deprived state, the cells were stubbornly resisting the message from insulin and refusing to open up their surface channels. The cells were repelling rather than absorbing the dangerously high levels of glucose. The roadside drains were effectively closed shut, leading to a rising tide of blood sugar and a pre-diabetic state of hyperglycemia. While many in the general public understand that diabetes is serious, they may not appreciate the true burden. Beyond the average treatment cost of more than $85,000 per patient, which contributes to higher medical insurance premiums, diabetes lops 10 years off an individual's life expectancy. Chronic sleep deprivation is now recognized as one of the major contributors to the escalation of type 2 diabetes throughout first world countries. It's a preventable contribution. Weight gain and obesity. When your sleep becomes short, you will gain weight. Multiple forces conspire to expand your waistline. The first concerns two hormones controlling appetite, leptin and ghrelin. Leptin signals a sense of feeling full. When circulating levels of leptin are high, your appetite is blunted and you don't feel like eating. Ghrelin, in contrast, triggers a strong sensation of hunger. When ghrelin levels increase, so too does your desire to eat. An imbalance of either one of these hormones can trigger increased eating and thus body weight. Perturb both in the wrong direction, and weight gain is more than probable. Over the past 30 years, my colleague, Dr. Ev Van Carter, at the University of Chicago, has tirelessly conducted research on the link between sleep and appetite that is as brilliant as it is impactful. Rather than depriving individuals of a full night of sleep, Van Carter has taken a more relevant approach. She recognized that more than a third of individuals in industrialized societies sleep less than 5 to 6 hours a night during the week. So in a first series of studies of healthy young adults of perfectly normal weight, she began to investigate whether 1 week of this societally typical short sleep was enough to disrupt levels of either leptin or ghrelin or both. If you are a participant in one of Van Carter's studies, it feels rather more like a 1 week stay at a hotel. You will get your own room, bed, clean sheets, a television, internet access, etc. Everything except free tea and coffee, since no caffeine is allowed. In one arm of the experiment, you will be given an 8.5 hour sleep opportunity each night for 5 nights, recorded with electrodes placed on your head. In the other arm of the study, you are only allowed 4 to 5 hours of sleep for 5 nights, also measured with electrode recordings. In both study arms, you will receive exactly the same amount and type of food, and your degree of physical activity is also held constant. Each day, your sense of hunger and food intake are monitored, as are your circulating levels of leptin and ghrelin. Using precisely this experimental design in a group of healthy, lean participants, Van Carter discovered